series is organised by the Howard Lee Penal Forum and the Mannheim Centre for Criminology and Criminal Justice at the LSE. This is now, I don't know, there's been a number of these over the last few years. The overarching idea is to have a discussion leading to a pamphlet or a publication of some sort, making adventurous, possibly radical proposals about elements of the criminal justice system, for reforming elements of the criminal justice system, which are nevertheless conceivable, practical, not just the kind of academic theory that I do in my professional life, but could conceivably be achieved. And so previous discussions have looked at whether what if there was no imprisonment for theft, what if we abolished women's imprisonment altogether, what if police bail was abolished. Well, tonight, similarly in that theme, we're going to ask what if we got rid of the dock in courts in England and Wales. And to discuss that and to put that proposal, I think argue broadly in favour of that proposal, we have two speakers tonight from the Lord of Parliament London School of Economics, Professor Lynda Mulcahy, a leading socio-legal researcher, into the broader aspects of the many aspects of the legal system, but she's spent the last 3 years in the National Archives looking and studying court architecture with a view to a book which she's now writing called The Democratic
Courthouse.
The Democratic Courthouse, coming to a bookshop or website near you soon. So Lynda's going to talk to us about the history of policy on the architecture of the courts and the dock in particular. And then Dr. Margaret Rossner is going to follow up to, who is an expert in the micro-sociology of criminal justice encounters. And he's done a lot of work on restorative justice and the way people react to each other and what's involved in the restorative justice encounter. And is currently working on a project working with mock juries and their attitudes to confinement of the defendant in the dock and the effects that has on the presumption of innocence. So Margaret is going to talk to that. And then following their introductions to the discussion, we will have responses from Abigail Bright, who is a barrister from Doughty Street Chambers with lots of experience of defending particularly young people in the Crown Court in England and Wales. And following her, Chris Henley, who's made it just some time. Chris Henley QC from Carmelite Chambers, who has a long and very varied experience in criminal practice, defending for all types of crime, including a great deal of serious crime, and is happily also, for our purposes, the vice chair of the Criminal Bar Association. And then after Abigail and Chris have spoken, we will have Paula Bakken, who is an intermediary, as someone who has actual experience, and indeed a great deal of experience, of sitting in a dock in the Crown Court, not as a defendant, as far as I know, but as an intermediary, somebody whose work is to explain and to help particularly vulnerable defendants understand the processes that they're involved in. And so Paula Bakken will be our last respondent. After that, we'll open up the discussion to the questions or comments you may have. If you are a tweeter, if you're on Twitter and you're liking on Twitter, the hashtag is #WhatIf. And if it's absolutely thrilling and you want to return to the experience tomorrow, the LSE will be podcasting it. I don't know if you've got LSE podcast, WhatIf, I'm not quite sure what the exact address is, but there will be an LSE podcast of this event as well. So that's the layout for the evening. I'll ask Lynda to start us off.
Great, well thank you very much for everyone for coming along on a bit of a miserable Tuesday evening. Really appreciate it. And Meredith and I are particularly grateful because we wanted to talk to you about something that we care very passionately about. I'm afraid Peter made me sound like an archetypal, boring academic who's been in the archives for 3 years. I do really, really love being in the archives in a really nerdy way, but I do also get out and about, and I spend quite a lot of time in courts, as does Meredith, and we're part of an international group of architects and judges who actually go on a court tour every year and spend pretty much 2 weeks talking about court design and what it is that we're trying to achieve in court. So what we're talking about tonight is part of, for us, a much broader project. So just to give you a little bit of background about the role that I'm going to play tonight, I'm going to talk about my work in the archives over the last 3 years, a little bit about the history of the dock. I think it's interesting because there's some quite surprising stuff that comes out of the archives. And then Meredith's going to go on and talk about some empirical research that she's been doing about the impression of people when they are in the dock, in the trial. So I think those complement each other quite well. So I've been looking, probably for the last 10 years really, at the history of ideas about court design. And what I mean by that is I'm really interested in the modern criminal justice system and what it is that courthouses symbolise about the role of law in our society, or the role of law in the civic sphere. And I'm also more particularly interested in how the design of courts facilitates certain types of behaviour and prohibits certain types of behaviour. And I think there's quite a close connection between people's ability to participate and the environment in which they are placed in the trial. So my last book in 2010 was called Legal Architecture, Justice, Due Process and the Place of Law. And in that book, what I do is I chart the history of ideas back to the 15th century. And the central thesis in that book is that as our society has moved towards a democracy, the spaces in which people are tried have become increasingly undemocratic. Okay? So the book that I'm writing at the moment is actually just about the last 50 years of the history of ideas about court design, and that's why I've been spending so much time in the archives, supported by the Levy Hume Trust. And I've also been very lucky in getting access to Ministry of Justice archives for the last 50 years, relating to something called the Court Standards Working Party. I know that doesn't sound sexy, but stay with me. And those archives have actually been destroyed now. So it's really important that with my colleague Emma Rowd and I got in to have a look at that. And what's in those archives are the minutes and papers relating to meetings that were held between the Ministry of Justice and its predecessors, the Department of Environment, the Home Office, the Bar Council, the Law Society, all sorts of other stakeholders over a 50-year period. So you have charted the way in which they have negotiated what court should look like and what is important within the courthouse, what is important for us to actually achieve. And why have I chosen the last 50 years? Well, those of you who are as old as me will know that there was a massive change in the criminal justice system in the 1970s after the Beeching Commission report in 1969. And shortly afterwards, we set up the Crown Court system. So we abolished the assizes and set up the Crown Court system. And at the same time, a lot of responsibilities for the court was actually centralised for the first time and became the responsibility of the Lord Chancellor's Office, which was one of the predecessors of the Ministry of Justice. And so what became centralised as part of that was court design itself. Previously, it had been up to local authorities and county councils to design courts in whatever way that they wanted to. And suddenly we had centralised responsibility for that court design. So those archives then, from those early discussions, to me, are really important. And what we're going to look at tonight is particular issues about the dock, and also in particular the secure dock, which we will come onto in the course of our discussion. So Meredith and I are topping and tailing our talks tonight with a point which is basically that court design is very culturally specific. Here's my slide. She'll end with one that will show you a beautiful new court in one of the Nordic countries and how they are conceiving differently about design. But I think it's important for us to remember that across the world, courthouses are operating, or courts operating, on a really efficient, rational basis without the use of a dock. Okay. My example, one of my examples here, is America. I threw in the Frank Lloyd Wright design in Marion County, which is a round courthouse. The lawyers hate it, but it's been in operation for a number of years now. Next to that is a very typical court in Baltimore. In both of those instances, the defendant is sitting next to their lawyer in the courtroom. We also then have a design for a French court that Emma and I visited, which again shows a very different configuration and without the use of a jock. So I think it's really important for us to remember that although we're used to the jock in this country, actually there are legal systems that exist very well without it. Okay, so again, just to make the point about how historically specific the jock is, this is a picture, this is an illumination from what was a law textbook for students. It's one of four illuminations that are held in the Inner Temple. You can actually go down and see it with permission. A beautiful illumination. And what it is, it's the oldest surviving image that we have of an English courtroom. So it's quite special. And what I wanted to, there are lots of sort of slightly worrying indications here of how badly defendants are being looked after. If you look at the bottom of that picture, you'll see that whole row of defendants that are in shackles and are bearded. They've obviously been in a dungeon somewhere just before they come to trial. So I'm not advocating for that. But what I do want you to notice, there's a thin circle around it, but the defendant has actually got a blue top on. He's in the middle of the picture. He's standing next to his lawyer at the bar. So if we look back to practice this long ago, there was no such thing as a dock. And in fact, his lawyer isn't even within the inner well of the court. They are standing at the bar with their client. So where did the dock come from? How did we get to the position that we're in at the moment? Well, in historical terms, it's actually a relatively recent invention. The term dock itself can be traced back to 1586. It's rogue slang for an animal pen. And for many years, it was just used to describe what's called the bail dock in courtrooms. Trials were much quicker then. People had to be rushed through. The average criminal trial lasted for 12 minutes, I think Langbein and Beattie tell us. So you needed to get people through very quickly. So they all stood in one area, which was called the bail dock. Over time, a little recess appeared at the front of that bail dock where the person whose trial it was would stand. And then as trials got longer at the end of the 18th century and 19th century, when pesky lawyers started getting more involved in developing the law of evidence, we see the emergence of what we would recognise as a modern dock, which is that one defendant or set of defendants in one trial would stand together in that dock. Significantly, these docks are positioned in the centre of the courtroom. And while we did see some fortified docks, like the one in Newcastle, which has those rather unpleasant spikes in it, and those sorts of big docks with spikes aren't uncommon, but they're also not usual. Okay, so we do see them in Victorian courts, but they are not usual. And significantly, at the beginning of my particular study period, which is the 1970s, there's absolutely no consistency across the court estate at that point as to what docks look like and which courts have docks and which don't. There's one textbook written by Celia Hampton in the 1970s, describes the dock as a space for the defendant fronted by a simple bar. And some of you will recognise Bow Street Magistrates Court. There are so many iconic images of infamous criminals in that dock. It's really simple. Okay, it's really simple. And actually what we saw with the modernisation of the criminal justice system, with the birth of the Crown Court in the 1970s, was the Beattie Commission argued for a much more modern estate to be created. Okay, they wanted courthouses to be flatter. They wanted them to have much better facilities, and that's why I argue actually there's a slight democratisation of the courthouse in that period, because they want facilities for the public to be provided, they want witnesses to be looked after. So we do see, with the creation of the Crown Court system, sort of hope that courthouses will become more civilised places for the people that use them. Again, we also, around this time, see campaigns beginning for the abolition of the dock it's really appropriate that tonight is being hosted by the Howard League for Penal Reform, because they have been grumbling about the dock for a long time. I found records of them grumbling about it in 1930. They had a campaign in 1976. The Law Society Criminal Law Revision Committee had a campaign in 1966 to try and get the dock abolished, and they were almost successful then, with Lord Gardiner, who I think was one of our most important reforming Lord Chancellors of the 20th century, fully behind the abolition of the dock. There was a documentary just before he died in which he said it was his greatest failure. Okay, and that was somebody who legalised homosexual sex and got rid of the death penalty in this country, said that his failure to get the dock abolished was one of his greatest failures. So a lot of movement around this time. Magistrates Association had been very supportive over that period of the abolition of the dock. And Jodie just came in. Jodie has recently written a report for Justice as well, calling for the abolition of the dock. So this is an issue that keeps on rumbling on and that people have been concerned about. So why in the 60s and 70s did those campaigns fail? I think it's actually quite simple. There was an awful lot of weight behind these campaigns that were lodged in the 60s and 70s. Why did they fail? On both occasions, it was because the Home Office and prison governors expressed concern about the security in the courtroom. And here I think it's significant to recall that when people are in custody, they are brought to the courthouse from prisons in sweat boxes, as they're called, and they're brought to the cells at the bottom of the courthouse, and then they are brought up into the dock. Throughout that period, it is the prison service that is responsible for guarding the defendant. Okay, so if they escape during that period, it is the prison service that gets in trouble for it. Okay. The prison service do not want to be responsible for the rest of the courtroom. They only want to be responsible for the bit that they consider to be their jurisdiction, which is the docking bay, where people, where the vans arrive. It's the custody suite. It's the corridors up into the dock and the dock itself. So actually the edge of the dock then can be seen as a jurisdictional boundary. So every time there was a campaign for the abolition of the dock, the prison service were very vocal in saying that they didn't want this to happen. Okay? So the incentive actually for the prison service is to see the increasing fortification of the dock, because they want to make sure that they are not responsible for anything that happens. So people jump outside of their jurisdiction and go into the courtroom. Okay, so despite all this noise about the abolition of the dock, we actually see the first docks being introduced as a universal feature in all Crown Courts in the 1970s. Okay. So they have been in some courts, not in others. For the first time in the 1970s, in 1971, there's a document that assumes that there will be a dock in every courtroom. And significantly, it places the courtroom at the back. It places the dock at the back of the court. So remember in those Victorian courts, the dock, when it was present, was in the middle of the court. It was in the well of the court. And suddenly it goes to the back of the court. So that's significant for me. But you can see from this photograph, which is a very rare photograph, somebody who is as nerdy as me and gets a photograph album of courts of the 1970s, thank you, that actually the dock remains really modest. It's remote, it feels remote, it feels a long way away at the back of the court, but it is actually quite modest. Okay, then we get something called the Teddington Experiment, which Emma and I got really excited about, the Teddington Experiment. I can't tell you how pleased we were to find this photograph of what was a mock-up court in a government facility in Teddington. Okay, it was one of three experiments that the Ministry of Justice and its predecessors actually launched, where they mocked up a court and they got judges and barristers and probation officers and all sorts of people to come along and comment on the layout of the court. They did this at Teddington in 1989 for two reasons. First of all, to test out new IT facilities, which meant lots of cables and really big screens. And secondly, to look at the issue of security. And what we see at Teddington, you can't see it terribly well in the photo on the right, but we see the simple rail at the front of the dock is suddenly replaced by a glass screen. So this is the first time that we actually see glass being used. And that becomes really relevant, the use of glass in the dock. Interestingly, in Teddington, the increasing, what I call, fortification of the dock was justified on two grounds. First of all, the defendants might jump the dock, they might escape. And secondly, that defendants were at risk from the public. Okay, and around this time, we also see screens, glazed screens appearing in the courthouse in the areas of the courtroom that separate the public from the defendant. So in many courtrooms, I was just talking to somebody about courthouses in the Northern Circuit, which are particularly have a lot of fortification. You see a lot of these large screens that you can't actually see the defendant in the dock. You're not meant to. There's a fear about the public eyeballing and the defendant and causing them distress. In the Teddington experiment, we also see lots more attempts at heightened security. The rolling bar is probably one of the funniest. They introduced a bar at the top of the dock to stop people escaping because they won't be able to put their foot on there. If they do, it will slip. Actually, what happened was that people just rolled over the bar and got out much more easily. I love these experiments. The second one is the creation of the moat. You will see in this cross-section there's actually a dip below the defendant, and it creates extra space between the defendant and the front of the dock. Okay? And this means if they try and jump out, the first thing they will do is they will fall down. Okay? Now, the moat is quite common in a lot of courts now, and actually what it does is it just increases the distance between the defendant and their barrister. But that's been quite a successful experiment. We see the writing tablet arriving in 1985. It used to be the case that at the front of the dock in the 1970s there would be a shelf that the defendant could use to put their papers on and if they needed to write. That was done away with because the moat, it wasn't realistic for you to have a shelf when the front of the dock was so far away from you. So they began to introduce these writing tablets, and then those were done away with as well. So actually, it is not a specification in the design guidance that defendants should have anything to write on. They have no facilities for writing in the dock. So the secure dock, we then see the next step up, which is the introduction of secure dock. The first secure docks only become compulsory to have a portion of your docks in a courthouse as secure docks in 2000. Okay, so this is a relatively recent phenomenon. And most glass docks actually have glass walls that go up to the ceiling. In Crown Courts, they're at the back of the court. In Magistrates' Courts, they are at the side. They're not complete sheets of glass. They are strips of glass with 25mm air gaps between them. So let me just show you the last dock to be constructed in an English courthouse. In case you're confused, it's the public that are above the dock. So there's no discrimination between members of the laity here. They're both in their own glass box in the courtroom. I find this actually quite striking. So let me just recap then before I hand over to Meredith. So we have defendants who are presumed innocent and have a right to be treated in a dignified way and a right to counsel. We place them at the back of the court. Their barrister sits with their back to them. They're contained in a glass room within a room, or what some people have started calling a glass cage. It's not possible for them to whisper in the ear of their counsel, as they might be able to do in an American setting. It's not possible for them to issue discreet instructions or ask questions. For those of us who court sit a lot, normally a barrister will know that their client is trying to get in touch with them because the judge will tell them your client is trying to attract your attention, or an usher will have to intervene. It can be difficult to hear everything that goes on, and your sight lines with other members of the court are commonly interrupted because when counsel stand up, that can get in the way of you seeing anything. So my question before I hand over to Meredith then is, does this constitute meaningful participation in the trial?
No.
I'm done. No. That's great. Thank you, Linda. So I'm going to actually pick up right where Linda left off. She made an important point at the beginning that there is a diversity of design over the writing world, and many, many
that is a German is the Dusseldorf court. That's their high security terrorism court. Below that is, you would have seen those images from the BBC. Those are the British and Australian Al Jazeera journalists who were on trial in Egypt a couple of years ago. And then the bottom left image is actually Breivik at his trial in Oslo. So that's the outlier. You see him sitting next to his lawyer, right? This is the most violent crime in the history of Norway. Most high-profile trial, he's sitting right beside his lawyer. We also, you know, have the iconic images of O.J. Simpson, right, sitting with his lawyer. That's kind of the standard image in there. So it is a trend both in common law and in civil law countries to have increasing security. But at the same time, I think it's really important to recognize that from the very beginning of the appearance of docs, they've actually been challenged right from the beginning. Linda spoke about some of the more principal challenges, the campaigns to abolish the dock from the Howard League, the Law Society, Justice. There's also been clients and then lawyers asking on a case-by-case basis for judicial discretion. And in fact, Abigail was mentioning some examples in her practice of doing this very same thing. Judges have always had discretion to allow defendants to come out of the dock and sit with counsel. But there's no sort of principled sort of standard to keep people in the dock. So when cases have been challenged, they've been on really three main grounds. The first one, and the most common one, as Linda said, is effective participation. So the ability to hear, the ability to consult with your lawyer, access to counsel. The second, and this is the one that most of the European cases are focused on, are on dignity, right? The prohibition against degrading treatment, that is degrading to put someone in a glass cage. And the third one, which I'm going to focus on my empirical research, is the presumption that it violates the presumption of innocence. Does someone look more guilty when they're in a box, when they're in a glass box during their trial versus when they're sitting in front of a lawyer? I think that's an empirical question, so I'll try to use some empirical methods to answer that. But first, I just want to briefly canvas some of the case law around it, because there have actually been a number of challenges. The U.S. used to have the dock, in fact. Colonial courts in America were built just like British courts. They were colonial courts, so all up and down the Eastern Seaboard, you have courts that look very much like 18th and 19th century British courts replete with a dock. It wasn't actually until 1914 that Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the right to sit at a bar table, to sit with your lawyer in order to instruct counsel, was a fundamental right. So Pennsylvania kind of leads the country with abolishing the dock. All defendants come out of the dock in 1914 in Pennsylvania. And what you see is that new courts that are built after that period, going westward in America, tend to be built without docks. So you don't see any docks. You see docks in older colonial courthouses. Massachusetts is still the only state to have docks, but they're used for ceremonial purposes. As Linda said, you mean for ceremonial degradation, I guess. There's also kind of a very strong jurisprudence in the states about anything that could be construed as a brand of incarceration. So a lot of cases around defendants wearing jumpsuits, around shackling, around docks. And there's a very strong kind of legal precedent that during a trial, it's the court's obligation to do everything they can to go above and beyond the call, if you will, to reduce anything that can be construed as a brand of incarceration. And docs fit that model. I don't want you to think I'm glamorizing what the treatment of defendants in U.S. courts, because I'm not. They do all sorts of dodgy stuff, like make defendants wear stud belts underneath their clothes or be secretly shackled to the floor. And there's all sorts of examples of this going awry during the trial. But the principle is there. So those are mostly issues around dignity and around participation. A Massachusetts court, this is the most recent hearing in 1983, does deal with the right with the presumption of innocence. And they argue that the right to a fair trial is too delicate and valuable to be impeded by an anachronistic practice. So as a general matter, the dock should not be used. I should mention that Irish courts actually came to a similar conclusion in the 1960s, that it was an anachronistic practice, and they used very similar language, and that the dock should be phased out. I used to go around saying, Ireland abolished the dock in the 1960s, and I went to Ireland and visited the courts there. It turns out, I go into a courtroom, and I see a spot where the accused sits, and I say, hey, what's that? And they said, oh, that's the place for the accused. They just renamed it. So there actually is still a dock in practice. But no, these are all open docks, not secure docks. There's been a number of really important European Court of Human Rights challenges. I'm only going to focus on two here because they're immediately relevant to what's happening in Britain right now. The first is from 3 years ago, the Svinarenko case. This was a Russian case where the defendants were actually held not in a glass dock, but in a metal cage, okay, behind bars. And they argued, this was a dignity free argument, that containment in the dock was akin to being a monkey in the zoo, in other words. And the court ruled that this was objectively degrading in nature. The objectively degrading nature of cage docks is incompatible with the standards of civilized behavior that are the hallmark of a democratic society. So you might say, yeah, but we're much more civilized. Right, we put people behind glass. Well, the judges did issue in the joint concurring opinion, they do mention that many other countries are moving from metal to glass, to the British style kind of glass cage, and they anticipate the problem here. They say that such cages might raise issues under the requirement of procedural fairness, so these are Article 6 issues, right? So what that actually looks like, just to remind you, you've probably seen these images. That's Pussy Riot in their dock during their trial. These images went around the world. That's the metal cage that gets challenged. So what happens in Russian courts is they move from that to that. That's the glass cage, okay? Not surprisingly, perhaps 2 years later, there's another Russian case going to the European Court about those glass cages. About this movement from a metal cage to a glass dock. Again, are both Article 3 and Article 6 challenges. I'm focusing on Article 6 here. The court argues that, first of all, they note that the dock was not used because of any specific security concern. No one was deemed particularly dangerous. Rather, it was a matter of routine, right? That sounds very familiar to actually the story here in Britain. There's no principal reason for using a dock in a specific case, rather it's used in all cases. And they ruled that the trial court doesn't seem to recognize the impact that these courtroom arrangements have on the defense rights, doesn't take any measure to compensate for these limitations, and that these circumstances prevailed for the entire duration of the trial, and it could not but adversely affect the fairness of the proceedings as a whole. Okay, so again, pretty major ruling about glass docks that's immediately relevant to the story in Britain. So why am I so concerned about the presumption of innocence? Why is it that I worry that putting someone in a glass cage not only is akin to degrading treatment, not only interferes with their right to counsel, but actually makes them look more guilty? Well, I'm worried about that. A lot of social psychological research out there that suggests that we should be worried that there's all sorts of cues that can lead us to be prejudiced to someone who's put in a box, put behind glass, put in a secure dock. We know that, for instance, we tend to be more sympathetic towards people who are like us, like subjects who are seen to be part of our in-group, not who are segregated, not who are seen as other, not who are seen as outliers. We tend to rely on status cues and peripheral cues when making judgments about people. So, for instance, if I know someone really well and I have a really good idea about, you know, who they are and what their story is, then I'm much more likely to not rely on peripheral cues, like what they look like or how they're dressed or the color of their skin. I'm much more likely to rely on what they say to make judgments about them. But if I don't know their story, right? I don't have a good idea about who they are, or I have conflicting evidence about them, or I'm not quite sure what to make, then I'm much more likely to rely on what these psychologists call status cues or peripheral cues, so other things about them that might help me make a decision about how reliable they are and how trustworthy they are, right? So you might argue that putting someone behind a glass cage is a very specific type of peripheral cue. We also know that furniture design influences behavior. Research about the types of chairs, this is why judges want to sit in their chair up high, right? This serves a very specific purpose. And also we have other, you know, research from other areas about what happens when we take, when we put glass between people. So for instance, in psychiatric hospitals, when they removed glass from the nurses' stations, the number of violent incidents went down. Similarly, in the United States, they had a big experiment with banks. When they removed the glass barrier in banks, armed robberies went down from removing the glass. It actually de-escalated the likelihood of violence, right? So, okay, that's all sort of, you know, evidence that suggests that there might be something about the doc. But what about something really empirical around courtrooms and trials and how jurors actually view defendants? Well, I am a social scientist, so I thought, well, this is a good empirical question. I'm part of a group of researchers who do research on court design and jury decision making, and we got together and we came up with this idea that, okay, there's a lot of case law, and there's a lot of social psychological research that suggests that it might be prejudicial. Can we come up with some kind of experimental methodology to actually test whether or not docs are prejudicial? And that's what we've tried to do. In fact, in this courtroom here, this is in Sydney, this is a newly built trial court. It's their high security court where they hold their most high security cases, terrorism cases. And the dock is very similar to the dock that Linda showed at the very end, because it's recessed. It's on the left behind glass, so the defendants are actually in almost a separate room. So we have a very simple question. Is the dock prejudicial? And secondly, is a secure dock even more prejudicial? Right? Really simple. This is why I love experiments. We can ask really simple questions, and methodology is quite straightforward. And so what we did was that in that very courtroom, we worked with a judge who had presided over a pretty high-profile terrorism case where there was an application made for the defendants to come out of the dock and sit with the lawyer. And rather than having them come out of the dock and sit with the lawyer, he did actually order that the glass be removed. So he said they could sit in the dock. So we based the case on that actual case. I was in trial for a conspiracy to commit a terrorist act with all circumstantial evidence. We had an actual judge play the role of a judge. We had actors play the role of counsel, witnesses, defendant, and we repeated it lots of times. We had a lot of control. It was in the exact same courtroom, the exact same evidence, the exact same defendants acting the exact same way every single time. The only difference was that one third of the time the defendant sat at the bar table with his counsel. One third of the time he sat in an open dock, and one third of the time he sat in a secure dock, right? And then in each, we repeated these many times, and we had members of the public come in who were jury eligible. So these are people who kind of fit the demographic profile of jurors. This took place in Sydney. So we were able to kind of stratify the sample. So it was the age, the education, the gender, the kind of race balance was reflected that of the actual jury pool. And what we're able to do, even though it's a controlled experiment, is show that if there's any change in how jurors perceive the defendant, we can feel reasonably confident that it's because of where they're located, right? So we are mostly looking, I'm going to really just report on the verdict outcome. So whether or not, this is the big money question, or were they more likely to convict? Okay, this is my big conclusion. Yes, they were. Again, with the exact same evidence, the exact same characters playing their role. When the accused was sitting at the bar table, they convicted 33% of the time. When they were in any kind of dock, they convicted 47% of the time. Right? One of the interesting findings here was it actually didn't matter if it was a secure dock or an open dock. was seemed to be any kind of confinement, any kind of separation of the defendant. They were quite far away from counsel. This wasn't the British courts, where they're even further away at the back. These are more like the magistrates' courts in Britain, where they're actually on the side. Just some a bit more detailed findings. We surveyed them about how punitive they were beforehand, if they had punitive attitudes. This is not statistically significant, but it's substantively significant. If they said to us in the survey beforehand that they were more punitive, if they had more punitive attitudes, the doc had a much stronger impact than if they had less punitive attitudes. And then finally, I spent a lot of time describing to you what I meant by peripheral cues and status cues, right? If you don't know what to make of someone, how do you make decisions, and you look to the periphery. That echoes what happens in a trial, right? Cases go to trial because we're not quite sure. It's not slam dunk either way, right? So we surveyed the jurors about how strong they thought the evidence was. And what's not surprising is that when they thought the evidence was really, really strong, that's the fourth quartile, they were much more likely to convict. And it didn't really matter where the defendant sat. They thought the evidence was strong, they convicted. The first quartile, they thought the evidence was quite weak. They were much more likely to acquit. Again, the doc didn't really matter. It didn't really matter where they sit. But what's important, and this is actually where the majority of jurors usually are, and this is why we have jury trials, is where you're not quite sure, right? There's some strong evidence that the prosecution puts forward. There's also some strong evidence that the defense puts forward. And it's those cases, right, that the doc seem to make a difference. And that's where the doc seems to be a peripheral cue that people are drawing on. So my conclusion, this is the Howard League event, the what-if event after all, is that the doc should be abolished because it's prejudicial. This is echoed in the report of justice recently published that Linda mentioned before. And, you know, the question that I think I would like to leave us with is, well, then if not the doc, what, right? And I think that can open us up to a discussion for what a flexible courtroom actually means, right? How do we maintain the presumption of innocence, dignity, and security in a court, right? Is that through, you know, this is the time to have this discussion. We're going through a major court reform process. 80 courts are being shut across the country. We're introducing new technology. We're introducing new standards for what a court should look like, right? Now is the time to draw on research like I presented today to rethink what a court can look like. I'll end with that.
Thank you, Meredith. I'll ask Abigail Bright to.
I have one more slide, but I forgot, so don't worry about it.
Yeah. You'll respond. You'll do that. Yeah.
Thanks. Yes.
Judge back at work after attack. A prisoner beats up woman judge at the Old Bailey. That's how the Telegraph reported what happened in January 2001 at the Central Criminal Court. And incidentally, the judge did then happen to be the only permanent female judge at the Central Criminal Court. That was an attack on a judge, the judge aged 64, Judge Anne Goddard. The result of it was her left eye was blackened, she had a head injury that needed 5 stitches. She was back at work within 48 hours at the Central Criminal Court. That attack on her by a defendant who was sitting in ADOC in court was at a preliminary hearing. In the event, he was convicted at the date of trial and sent to a secure hospital. That last sentencing outcome is a reliable indicator of his own extreme vulnerability. Chaos as judge is punched in court. Chaos, so it's got to be the Daily Mail. That's the Daily Mail's report of what happened at 3:15 an afternoon at not a criminal court but the interim applications court in the Royal Courts of Justice. This reported an attack on a High Court judge, later to become Lord Justice Pitchford. The judge was punched several times in the face in an attack in the courtroom. The judge was aged 55. He was left clutching his face. He had bruising to his face. Bridge of his nose was bruised. His left eye bruised, and he had a cut to the forehead. Again, he was back at work within 48 hours or so. Panic alarm sounded, and the attacker was restrained. And the Daily Mail also reported that a lamp was broken in the attack, and that Daily Mail thought was prima facie case of criminal damage. In fact, the lamp was reported before what happened to the judge. But the point is that on the court estate, that happened not in a criminal courtroom at all, but a radically different setting, with a civil applicant, civil, grieved, disaffected, clearly very disappointed applicant. In the courtroom that deals with emergency pleas for injunctions. The point is that the court estate, it is radically different. And we really do need to think from first principles why it is that in the 1970s or so we introduce whether an open or a closed, secure or insecure dock in criminal courtrooms. It's very easy to think of other court forums where people have very heightened emotions and can be labile and act in volatile ways. Family courts, immigration tribunals are immediate examples where people often don't act rationally. The stakes are very high indeed, and outcomes can be adverse to individuals. So those two cases really do perhaps demonstrate how the court estate differs. There was never ever going to be a dock in the court to try and contain, restrain the civil applicant at the RCJ in that case. Courtroom state really does differ radically also amongst criminal courtrooms. At Durham, a courtroom that is historic, hundreds of years old, and it's unmodified, and at the Newcastle Moot Hall, which is an overflow now for the Newcastle Crown Court. Again, it's an unmodified court. And what I mean by that is that there is an area for a defendant to sit in, demarcated as such, but it's totally indistinguishable to and from the area where the press would sit, public gallery would sit, and other interested persons. It's different only because, very discreetly at the sides, that presumably defendant who's on bail can see, whilst jailers who are accompanying defendant who's not on bail can see, it just says dock, very discreetly at the time. And what that means is at Durham and at the Newcastle Moot Hall, a defendant who is on trial, regardless of the kind of the offence alleged, sits behind their counsel, could reach and touch their counsel, certainly could whisper in their ear, pass notes. The point is, it can seamlessly have communication with their counsel. There's no disruption with somebody knocking on a glass box to say, I'm sorry, I can't hear, if they're articulate and bold enough and brave enough to do that. There is simply a seamless interaction between them, really the person who matters most and who the stakes are highest, and the person who represents them. That must be a good thing. It's unmodified from hundreds of years ago. And yet, the Ministry of Justice administer those two courtrooms. And the security contractor that the Ministry of Justice commissions to secure all courtrooms ministers to the same. So clearly, the same risk assessment, adequacy and accuracy of risk assessment has been undertaken between those two courtrooms, unmodified, hundreds of years ago to now, and every other courtroom. So I think that that's pretty important. I've prepared a handout that's going to be for general circulation, and really what that covers is how does DOC differ presently across courtroom estate. We have that in headlines. It covers really why there is no reason, I think, to distinguish between applications that are made for the use of handcuffs of an accused who is to stand trial and the use of DOC. So what I propose to do now in the remaining 3 or so minutes is to whiz through what I propose our conclusions to be drawn. You can read the substance and the underlying stuff in the handout at your leisure. So the conclusions then I propose are these. There should be no presumption in courtrooms in England and Wales that we use docks, whether secure, insecure, open, closed docks. There just should be no presumption. No policy of law justifies there being any such presumption. If ever there was any justification for the same, I propose that it doesn't exist rationally or on any basis in terms of efficiency. In fact, use of the dock is inefficient and slows down trials. And there's no reason beyond any policy of the law by reason of, I think, principle. There's no reason to distinguish the dock and using that from using handcuffs. Judges rightly are sensitive to and sceptical about use of handcuffs in courtrooms, even though it's a quid pro quo that if an application for handcuffs is made and granted, the jury must never be able to see that the person who is standing trial is in handcuffs. There must be some way to discreetly disguise that. And yet judges rightly are cautious and circumspect about any such application for handcuffs. So really what I propose is that in the same way that judges have developed a now familiar and iterated procedure for any application by the Crown or by the jailers who produce defendants to the court trial, in the same way that judges have developed a familiar procedure to do with application for handcuffs, there really should be the same for use of the dock. The application for handcuffs really is a very simple one, and it is this. There needs to be an application. Everyone should be on notice of it, not necessarily in terms of a set period, but just sufficient time to reflect on it and to consider it on its merits and respond to it if it's made without merit. The application needs to be in writing. It needs to be communicated to the defendant and any representative. And the defendant or any representative that they have should be able to question it on its merits. And usually, pretty much invariably, that is by electing to cross-examine the jailer or other personnel who makes the application. So that is the procedure, and the application, I should say, also needs to be made in the presence of, or inter partes, in the presence of the defendant, their legal representative. So that's the procedure. And it seems to me that any application for use of the dock should really be made clear by the prosecution, or for what it's worth, jailers, if they're to make any such application, at the stage two, or case management, second stage, of Crown Court trials. And the same hold true of Magistrates Court trial, that would be the first appearance. In the same way, at stage two, that the Crown would notify the court of any application to do with admission of defendant's bad character at the trial, or any application to adduce and admit hearsay evidence, the same really should apply to any application for use of DOC. And I think it should be pleaded in writing, on notice, made orally inter partes with an opportunity to question it and to cross-examine on it. And really, what I really finish with is this. In reality, I think the critical number of any such applications, if they had to be on notice, in writing, with opportunity to question, would be very few and very limited indeed. Putting things in writing generally, putting people on notice, tends to focus minds, and it means that baseless things fall away and aren't ventilated and articulated. I suspect that the critical number of any such applications that were to be made would be vanishing. Stage two is, apart from many applications, adverse to a defendant, is also the stage, incidentally, when the Crown would apply for use of special measures for a vulnerable witness to be heard at the trial. So it's absolutely the right stage, I think, for the Crown to make clear, or James to make clear, that they rely on an application for use of the dock. So it seems to me that reform of the dock and getting rid of it in England and Wales would assist justice, truly. Cosmetically, the optics of the courtroom are important, and it would assist justice in terms of access to justice and meaningful participation in the experience that is being on trial for an accused person. That there wouldn't be any cost involved at all in that reform. Rather, it would mean that I think we have a thorough and fresh review and rethink about how we use our courtroom estate. And we should get rid of the old idea that, like a sort of Lego set, you build something that includes a dock, which really actually probably, to most even fair-minded, dispassionate jurors, probably does look indistinguishable to a prison. So those are my submissions to you. I hope they're my
favour. Thank you, Abigail. Chris Henry to Abby Sports.
At the moment, I'm defending one of two 19-year-olds charged with murder. And they are sitting in a secure dock in Leicester Crown Court, as far as a bit late, coming from there. And there's no doubt they look very guilty. And worse, they talk to each other during the trial, and it's impossible for them to communicate with their lawyers. If they want to speak to me, or if they want to speak to the other defence barrister, they have to put their hand up. Judge then will groan and say, "Oh, I think your client wants a word with you. Maybe, you know, could you have a word through the, you know, through the glass at the back of the courtroom?" I mean, it's pretty ridiculous, really. And there's an increasing contrast between the way that, and this isn't unreasonable, and I'm not opposed to it, but there's an increasing contrast between the way prosecution witnesses, particularly the young or the vulnerable, are being treated in a very humane way, and the way in which defendants are treated, which is, to be frank, increasingly brutal. A book that made a big impression on me a few years ago was written by Blake Morrison about the Bulger trial, a book called As If. And that's worth reading if you're interested, as obviously all of you are, in these sorts of issues, the description of how those two young boys, constantly described as youths when the case was appealed, but they weren't, they were boys, little, scared little boys, holding hands with the adult sitting next to them, one of them crying during the trial. And I have some limited experience of something similar because I acted for the first defendant, I was the junior counsel, in one of the Davalola Taylor trials. I'm going to go through all the history, but two sets of defendants were tried. I was in the second set of trials, which were retrials, if I say set. And I was the first defendant. And that, again, was pretty brutal. He was 17, quite tough, or at least he acted tough, but fundamentally very, very vulnerable. And I'll never forget the moment when they were found guilty of manslaughter. And in the circumstances, the sentence wasn't too harsh. But I'll never forget the older of the two boys banging on the glass and crying out frustration. And people shouldn't be treated like that. And it's interesting because thinking about these things in preparation for this evening and Googling the various articles which have been written about this, almost all by Meredith, that's a joke. It has made me think. I mean, it is depressing how resigned or unthinking the bar is as a profession about the impact of the way that defendants are treated. And there is no doubt that when you walk through the door as a jury, as a juror, or you walk through the door as a lawyer, or as you walk through a different door and you're the judge, a defendant is at an immediate disadvantage if they're sitting in a secure dock. And the research, the data of the bar charts that we put up a little bit earlier, are fascinating and seem to completely confirm one's instincts about this sort of thing. No direction from a judge in the world is going to change the very strong subconscious subliminal message that is sent out. When you turn to look at the dock and you see officers, jailers sitting in there as well, defendants cooped up and on the other side of the thick glass type screen, completely enclosed. And it doesn't matter, obviously, as the statistics seem to show, the research data. If the case is very, very weak, you'll be okay. If the case is very, very strong, you won't be okay. It's the cases in the middle that it really matters. And it does seem to me that having now reflected upon it, we really need to be stepping up as a profession and raising this issue and championing the issue. So we're giving all the support we possibly can to organisations like the Howard League and Justice to do something about this. Over the last few years, I mean, literally, very recently, almost every court that I've appeared in is exclusively made up of these secure docks. I was trying to think of a court that didn't have one. Southwark, I think all of them are secure. Wood Green, they're all secure. Your Bailey, they're all secure. I mean, it is extraordinary. I mean, no one is thinking about this. It's just an unthinking, we've got security to the max. And it's completely unnecessary. And it offends against three fundamental principles. The prejudice, the presumption of innocence, completely offends against that. It offends against the importance of defendants participating in their own trial. And it also offends against the dignity of defendants on trial. They are presumed innocent. And even if convicted, they should be treated properly. If it can be done in America, where they kill people, I'm allowed to say that. I don't understand why we can't do it here, why it's not higher up the agenda. And also in my Googling for this, perhaps I should remember this, but at the beginning of 2015, when I think Justice launched a report that something was being published, and Lord Thomas came along and muttered a few warm, positive words about, yes, think about this. But he wasn't talking about the presumption of innocence and how it offended against that. He wasn't talking about the dignity of defendants. He said it was terribly expensive maintaining these secure docks. He's recently retired, which I think is a very good thing. Arguments in favour of retaining the dock. Asked a few of my colleagues at lunchtime about that, and we couldn't come up with very much. The obvious one is security, and there may be some very, very rare situations, as there must be in America, where serious consideration needs to be given and imagination shown to make sure that everyone else in the courtroom is safe. And there must be solutions. I remember being in one case where the door to the courtroom itself was locked discreetly once everyone was assembled. And there was a little bit of extra security, one or two extra police officers sitting in strategic positions just in case. Nothing happened, of course. And it's interesting that Abigail's referred to the two famous examples of recent times. And one of them was obviously somebody who was themselves vulnerable and disturbed. disturbed, but it's amazing how rare problems are. And there must be, I'm sure all the great legal minds could come up with solutions for those, a handful of cases that do pose security problems. And the only other comment that came back was, a direction from a judge can cure that. And it's one of my personal bugbears, this idea that if a judge says something, it somehow solves all the problems, because jurors are faithful always to judges' directions. And no doubt they do their very, very best. But no direction in the world, it seems to me, really solves that problem with a secure dock. So it's stark and depressing to me that at a time when America, Australia, where there's been this research carried out, New Zealand, Canada, obviously the Scandinavian countries, are moving in a progressive and humane direction. And at the same time, when resources are so limited, don't get me onto legal aid, we are devoting stupid amounts of money putting shoplifters in secure docks up and down the country. I had a farcical situation recently in a fraud trial where, in Southwark, where the dock was secure, one of the nicest judges at Southwark said that the door could be kept open and the defendants would stretch their legs because it was a long and not very interesting trial, and they could come and go as they wanted. And, unfortunately, the defendants took full advantage of that, so the rules have to be really pleasant. But the debate really should not be about whether docs should be abolished. The debate should be about how we achieve it.
Thank you, Chris. Finally, Paula. You can tell us about the experience of being in there.
I'm going to start by saying that I have sat in about 60 Crown Court docks across the country. Oh, it's on there. I'm an intermediary. For those people who don't know what an intermediary is, there are intermediaries for witnesses that have been set up by a scheme from the Ministry of Justice since 2003. There is no scheme for defendants who need an intermediary. Currently, it is completely up to judges whether they use their inherent powers to appoint an intermediary. Now, what is an intermediary? If you're a vulnerable defendant who has difficulty communicating, either understanding or expressing yourself, has difficulty coping with the anxiety or your mental health condition, which is affecting your ability to deal with your trial, and your ability to just participate effectively in a trial, then you can have an intermediary to assist you. Many of us are speech and language therapists. There are other professions that have become involved. But we're basically specialists in communication. So I have sat in many docs, both in magistrates' courts and crown courts. I have the experience of also doing zone family courts and youth courts, and can compare how different that is when there isn't a secure dock. However, what I thought we should just have a think about is what it feels like to actually sit in that dock. So the first thing is the lock on the door. As an intermediary, if I want to go out of the room, I need permission from the security officer. And actually, security officers aren't really jailers, but they feel like they're your jailer. They want to check your bag when you come in. In fact, they'd rather you left your bag outside. And nobody's mentioned this. Actually, the defendant and myself as an intermediary can't really take anything into the dock. So we could just about have an inhaler with us if somebody needed it. We could just about have some pills if we left it with the security officer, for the security officer to give them to us when we needed them. We certainly have to give up our mobile phones, which, if you were sitting in the courtroom and you were innocent, why would you need to do that? Turn it off, but you don't have to. So here you are in a locked room. It feels like you are in a goldfish bowl. I can tell you that is the feeling. Very, not that I've ever been in one, but that is the feeling. I just want to mention the toilet, because nobody has. If you want to go to the toilet and you're in the dock, you have to go out the back. And it's not a very nice toilet. You can't have permission to leave the room and go to the toilet like somebody else who's sitting in the courtroom. You have to use the toilet out the back. You also can't hear very well. Now, some people say, well, put a hearing loop on. Well, actually, if you neither are not used to a hearing loop, it's a very strange thing. If you don't normally wear hearing aids, it's a very strange thing. And what happens is you hear selectively, because everybody in the court has their back to you except for the judge. So you're listening to people talking without you seeing any of the non-verbal clues to go with it. It's entirely about what you can hear just about, if you're lucky. And as barristers move away from the microphone, you fade in and out in terms of what you can actually hear. It has been mentioned there is no table. This is a real issue for me as an intermediary. I often want to use some visual aids to help the person with learning difficulties understand what's going on. I have nowhere to put my papers. Any defendant has nowhere to put their papers. There's no ledge. There's nothing to lean on. And that makes a huge difference to how you get through these documents. You also got a chair. I tried to find a picture of a chair that was actually bolted down, but I couldn't find one. But can I tell you, your chair is bolted down. So if you want to change your position in any way, you can't. And if you're an intermediary and you want to sit slightly on the side to talk to your defendant, you can't. And that's a picture of a window, basically because I wanted to mention those slits that somebody told me the diameter of just now. Documents are being pushed through that slit, and your conversation with counsel is also through that slit in the glass. It is a bizarre way to communicate. And if you want to attract attention, you really do have to either knock on the glass, raise your hand very high, start waving at the judge, which I do as an intermediary, I have to say, but I don't know any defendant who would feel comfortable doing that. I want to mention an 82-year-old man who I recently worked with, who had no criminal record, and was accused of a historic sex offence about 40 years previous. He was asked to sit in a glass dock. He was not a terribly well man, so sitting on this chair bolted down was not very comfortable for him. He couldn't hear very much of what was going on, and I'm not really sure what sort of a security risk he was to the court. Would have been, he needed his two walking sticks to move in and out of the courtroom, but they wanted him in a secure dock. However, I do want to give you some ray of hope. The role of intermediaries in courts, we ourselves believe as intermediaries, is a bit like we are stepping outside the box and pushing on any traditions that there are in courts. We are often the people who say to the judge, I know this hasn't happened before, but could we bring a dog into the court? We know this hasn't happened before, but could we sit at the back of the courtroom? We know this hasn't happened before, but do we need to be in the courtroom for the whole of the trial? Would it be acceptable for us to come in at the important bits? Because we're not going to understand anyway for most of the trial. So we're involved in stepping outside the box, and I did manage to get that 82-year-old man outside of the dock after the first day. We sat in the last row of seats. I actually don't really find it useful to sit next to counsel. I find that quite distracting. If I want to, particularly with a vulnerable person, because that's the only defendants I'm used to working with, if I want to be able to talk to them, show them things with visual aids, I'm interrupting what counsel are doing, and we're much better sitting behind. So it doesn't involve changing anything in the courtroom. You just need to use the last row, in my opinion. I just want to mention a 27-year-old mother of three that I worked with. Learning disabilities, mental health issues, and she spent 2 weeks inside a glass dock. She was very angry with her co-defendant who had pleaded guilty, and as a result, on the first day of the trial, and as a result, didn't need to stay for the 2 weeks. And in her mind, she'd drawn the short straw because she had to spend 2 weeks sitting in that glass box. She was acquitted at the end of that, and I did try to persuade her that the reason she was there was in the hope that she would be acquitted. But as far as she could say, the person who pleaded had got a good deal because they hadn't had to sit in the glass box for the whole time. Another issue about sitting with co-defendants. It is very difficult to sit in the glass box with a lot of co-defendants. The spacing isn't great. Some of the docks around the country, they do have some big docks. I've been in Liverpool with 8 or 9 co-defendants in the same box together. Then you end up with 2 security officers. I've seen where there's been a security officer between each person. I'm not sure why they needed to be behind the glass to keep them. I've also had a judge agree that we could sit outside of the box when there was prosecution evidence that we really needed to listen to. But for the rest of the time, we should stay in the box. Alternatives, I just think we need to come outside of the dock. We need to be sitting inside the courtroom. We need to be able to engage. I am concerned that most of my clients do not participate actively in their trial while they're in that dock.
Thank you very much. Do you want to sit back up here? Because I'm going to open up the discussion having up to the come up. Okay, so you've heard those views. Is anyone got anything they want to add to this? Yes, at the back. Joe, please.
Yeah. Thanks. We're hearing a lot about the produced our report on this issue 2 years ago and effectively said everything that's been raised here today in that report. And in fact, most of the recommendations Abigail that you were making are in that report. I'm sure you haven't read it, otherwise you'd mention that. But it's great that we're on the same
Jenny,
page.
You know I've read it.
I think it's interesting to then consider, well, why? Why do we have this thing that everyone thinks is so abhorrent? And the Russian case that Meredith mentioned, if you read that case, it describes a glass dock, which sounds exactly like the UK or England and Wales glass docks. And it says that breaches Article 3 and Article 6, which is the right to participate. Because you cannot talk to your counsel, you cannot hear, and you cannot take part in the trial. So as far as I'm concerned, and Joe Stone QC, he wrote an article with me in September in Archibald's Review, we are in breach of the European Convention on Human Rights by having a secure dock. We continue to have it because it's a convention that has crept up on us. There is no law that requires it. There is no procedure that requires it. It simply happens, and therefore it could not happen tomorrow. And it only relies on criminal practitioners in their cases to make these applications for its use to stop. The problem is that judges will always say, we will have a security problem if we don't use the dock, or it will not be good for the solemnity of the proceedings because the defendant has their place and they need to be in their place. So we really need to be changing cultural attitudes as much as anything. Justice has been having conversations, as have Meredith and Linda, with HMCTS about how we can change this. And there are new designs that don't have a dock in them that HMCTS at least is convinced would be much better. Probably because it's cheaper. But we have got to address the security problem because we no longer have police officers in our courtrooms maintaining security. They've gone and we can't afford them. So we have to come up with an imaginative response to that. We did ask the Lord Chief Justice in his previous iteration, Lord Justice Thomas, to create a practice direction that would require a presumption against the dock, and that there be a procedural hearing for an application to be made for its use. his view was that it wasn't within his gift to make such a change. It should go to the Queen's Procedural Committee. And I've been biding my time to make that application, because I sit on that committee and I know how much work we've got. But I think it's worth us all coming together and actually putting paper into the committee, which I can present, to make that request for procedural change. Because there's nothing really stopping it other than the security issue. And I think, I suppose, the one other thing, if we're honest about criminal barrister colleagues, is that your colleagues are reluctant to having this. Nobody wants a client sat next to them, distracting them during the case, and they're trying to put arguments forward. And I've had many barrister colleagues say that to me. Former treasurer of the CBA went on national radio nearly the day after our launch and said this is not a good idea because it would breach security and it would distract me from doing my job. And I found that incredibly important. So I think it's something we need to continue to have this conversation about. And it would be fantastic if the CBA is actually able to get behind this campaign with us and stop making applications.
Can I put that to you?
I agree with what you said. So I will take it back to key colleagues and see if we can do something about it to assist.
Thank you.
Could I just press the further point? Could you or your colleagues be making applications to judges to get the defence out of the dock and then conceivably mounting human rights appeals on the basis of the... on the basis of the ECHR judgment, is that?
I had a QC this morning actually email me and say I have a client who has a charge of misfeasance in public office who's in the dock, and I want to make an application to get them out. Do you have anything I can use? And I sent him some materials, and I'll wait to see how she got on with that.
But I did a case in the summer at Southwark, and very unusual case, very vulnerable female defendant, and she was allowed to sit just behind me with her mother during the trial. So it's always worth asking. I think the cultural reluctance that you have already spoken of is the biggest obstacle. And I think another article that I read was referred to the three MPs charged in relation to the expenses scandal, and that their lawyer asked if they could be excused from going into the dock, and the response was, well, everyone else has to, why shouldn't you? And I think that's, lawyers will be asked, barristers will be asked, what's so special about your client, which isn't the right question, but that's probably what will happen. But I think you're right, if people just keep, even if we get knocked back over and over and over and over again, if it becomes a standard request that's made, slowly we'll shift the iceberg of reluctance on it, I imagine. But it does require some fresh thinking right at the top of the judiciary, as you say, and we weren't going to get that from Thomas.
I think we've got to start thinking about the difference between those people who are on bail or those people on remand. I mean, it's a very different issue if the security officer is bringing them up from the cells, from somebody who's walked in off the street. If we've allowed them to walk around in the street, then why are we putting them in a locked room? I've recently sat with 2 weeks of a trial where, for the first 8 days, we had a security officer with us, and one day they didn't have anybody to... They didn't have enough staff, so we just sat there without one. Why did we bother?
But the problem then is the contrast. If you've got multiple defendants, some on bail, some not on bail, or it sends a very strong prejudicial message to the jury. I mean, I think it does require a bit of thought. I just don't believe it's beyond us to come up with a solution.
And that's actually how the campaign got stuck in '76, because some people were arguing, well, people on bail shouldn't be sitting in the dock, and then you get the whole thing about what happens when someone sits in the dock. I mean, Jodie and I had this argument, and I think we came to the conclusion we should just be abolishing them all. I mean, I think it's true to say it's not cost neutral, though, and we would have to deal with that argument. Because, I mean, there's no coincidence to me that you see the secure dock coming in a few years after the police decide that they will not routinely be in the courtroom, that they're only providing support to courtroom staff and that. And basically, courtrooms can be difficult places, we can't ignore that. But I think it's more to do with contracting out of prison service security and the police having to withdraw their support as part of the police bureaucracy task force. You know, so there were deliberate policies behind this in terms of them reducing the amount of time that they were in courts. But I mean, actually, they are needed if we serve the greater good, it seems to me.
Actually, Abigail, have you got anything to add, or should I take
only really, I suppose, Jodie, to say, well, first, that it was so nice to be invited to Justice a little while ago and to speak with you. And of course, you wrote that article with Joe. Joe's led me in several cases, and you and he really are at the very forefront in terms of practitioners' minds, I think, on this. You're absolutely right to say, in some ways, the height of the argument, which is some great height, is how can the UK government seriously and sensibly say it's not in breach of the clear stipulation in that recent Strasbourg case? So I suppose that really practitioners... many of us do, in every case, make the argument that the person we defend shouldn't be sitting in a dock, but we should put in the hard yards and take judges to that case and really ask judges why what the judge proposes to do is not in clear contravention. It's a real shame, as you said, that we can't refer to the clear stipulation of a practice direction. And it's a shame that a certain person's confidence and courage convictions failed them, because it really would have helped and assisted us. So I hope that you are able to place that argument in due course. I'm sure that the panel will do all it can to be your firepower behind that.
Okay, next question, yes.
Yeah. So a question related to the presumption of innocence issue, potentially from Meredith. So that research is so shocking that there's like this 50% differential between willingness to convict, dependent upon whether or not the defendant is in the dock. So clearly the dock impacts the willingness to convict, but then there seems to be a separate question, which seems to be the real question, which is, does the dock make it more likely that the juror can get it wrong?
Right.
And so, I mean, it seems obvious that the answer is yes, it is more likely that they get it wrong.
Yeah.
But that just the point, the social science point, that is probably the real question.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, you know, in this case, who got it right or wrong?
Right, so maybe the ones who convicted were the right ones.
Yeah, I mean, do you know?
No, so we did actually design the evidence so that we wanted like a 50-50 split. That was actually a methodological choice. We also, another part of it is that we videotaped the deliberations, and we were interested in how they kind of came to that decision. I haven't spoken about that, but that has been, that is a really important point. Maybe actually, maybe the doc is an important cue, right? I would probably, my hunch is it's not, but I would also respond that, you know, it's the court's duty to do everything they can to remove any layer of prejudice that's in their control. And in fact, the judge in the terrorism trial in Sydney, when he ordered the glass removed, made that same point. He said, you know, I don't know if you're guilty or not, but when I see you behind a dock, to me, you look more guilty, and it's my job as a judge to do everything I can to, in my power, to remove any layer of prejudice that's there in the court. And if the least I can do is have the glass taken out of the dock, then I'll do that. And I think, you know, this is one of the foundations, this is kind of the founding principles of our criminal procedure rules and of our, you know, common law. So I think it's our duty, if we think there's prejudice, to do something about it.
Yep.
Great presentation, thank you. More of a comment than a question, I'm afraid, I'm picking up on some points. I think that this issue of the dock should be considered in the broader issue of what role should defendants be playing in their criminal trials. At the moment, they're essentially treated as objects, so they're in their separate rooms at the back of the court, whereas arguably they are the subject of the criminal trial. They're the person on trial, they're the most important participant. And if we can see them in that way, then we have absolutely no reason to put them in the dock at the back of the court. And on the point of effective participation, this has been raised quite a bit, and I think that the dock absolutely violates Article 6 and no right to effective participation. And I need to read this latest Russian case in full, so correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but one limitation is that we don't have a clear definition or criteria of what effective participation is. And we've got European court jurisprudence, we've got Stanford in 1994, where the European court basically said he could effectively participate through his lawyer. So he couldn't hear from the doc, but the lawyer could hear on your behalf. And the Court of Appeal has similar reasoning in the Hamilton case earlier this year, with involuntary absence. So there's limitations there in the way that this right has been interpreted, but that also feeds back into, well, what should the role of the defendant be? So I think that, yeah, we should perhaps be considering a specific issue in that broader context.
Yes, you.
I'm a criminal barrister at Farthing Court Chambers, and I was involved in a case over the summer, which actually Paula was involved in, which did deal with effective participation for youths. And one of our points was about the defendant sitting in the dock. There was a lot of disruption, etc. So the first thing is that that judgment is not very good, by the way. But what it does establish is that there is a practice direction in relation to youths. Every time that you're dealing with a youth client, you do have to raise the issue of where they're going to sit. And that's the one thing that this case does establish, is that it has to be addressed in open court. And that's the case of McGill and others. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we are actually, because it was such a terrible judgment on effective participation, because essentially they ended up saying, well, even though no one thought about it, security would have trumped those considerations. We are taking it to Europe. So if anyone does have any research or cases, well, I would be very interested to, like, on reports.
On effective participation, if we can talk about it.
Okay, great. I'll be around, and if anyone does have anything.
And you are?
Shahida Begum at Farthing Court Chambers. Well, I'm definitely going to get the justice report, but I thought in case there's anybody else who's done some research, especially comparative studies, that would be really useful as well.
Great, thanks. I'll take more contributions, but if anyone, people are hearing a very powerful case against the dock. If any brave soul wants to pipe up in its favour, I would be particularly welcome that contribution in the stage of debate. Just, yeah, do you want that?
What exactly can speak to its favour? Coming on to the how do you do it, you watch the and so I'm a researcher at the HPCTS Change Programme. Something we've learned from judges in civil spaces is a concern about security and safety. Whether that's backed up by the statistics or not, it's another matter, but that's definitely a concern that some judges have. So in the criminal space, if we were to watch the dock, what do the panel think we could do to make all participants feel safe, feel comfortable?
I know, just from my personal experience, there's just been such creep on this issue that there never was this problem that secure docks were needed to address. I felt unsafe once in my career. And I'll tell you the anecdote, it's quite funny, this very angry defendant was brought in to see me afterwards in the cells, in handcuffs, and I was asked in front of him whether I was happy if his handcuffs were taken off. And I felt like the right answer was yes. I felt like the right answer was no. But I felt like the answer I had to give was yes. And the table, fortunately, wasn't secured to the ground, so I just kept my hands on the table and the first twitch, I was going to turn it over and scream. But it didn't come to that.
But that was in holding cell.
That was in the cell, yeah, but that was just me and him. But he was, you know, I just genuinely think that I think it's just not the issue that the people, and I also agree entirely, I mean, there's this thing about in completely different settings, the banks sort of changing their layouts, and the behaviour changes. I mean, I have been in a lot of cases involving people accused of serious violence, terrorist cases, murders, all sorts of things, young defendants, older defendants, and it's just never been an issue. Very occasionally, when sentences passed, a small number of defendants have kicked off at that point. But that's anticipated, and not in secure docks. There's been sufficient security because the warning signs have been there prior to the moment of sentence being passed. But maybe I'm being too dismissive. But as I say, they can do it in America. We can do it in this country.
I know you want to come in about how we screen off the public in a minute, so I don't want to take your point. But I mean, we need to ask who's the danger here, you know, when there is an outbreak of violence in the court. I mean, it isn't always the defendant. You know, there is this issue about sometimes it's the public that are at risk. So we might want to think about putting the public behind a glass screen, the way that gives transparency of the court and they can still see proceedings. I think we can also design our justice spaces much better. We have a lot of courtrooms in this country that have no natural light in them at all. One of the reasons why I do a lot of comparative work with Australia and why marriage has also been attracted to it there is there have been challenges in Australia from the Aboriginal community about the lack of light in courtrooms or the notion of the colonial courthouse. And I think they've designed some really beautiful, calming spaces there. So I think we can design to make people calmer in the first place. I think we should think about where we position people in the courtroom. There is actually no place in the Court Standards Design Guide, which is a 2,000-page document, that actually says where you should put opposing sides in the case. Now, we all know, those of us who spend a lot of time in courts, that ushers deal with that by trying to find different spaces. There is some flexible space in the courtroom, but there is actually nowhere to separate opposing sides. They do it at the Bailey, it's like going to a wedding. They say, you know, you prosecution or defence, you get separated. That's never been really thought about when we've been designing courts. And that seems really bizarre to me. You know, the most emotional players in the room are kept together in a public gallery where fights are going to break out. So you're sort of creating the environment, especially if you're creating a glass room like the Warwickshire court that I showed towards the end. You're putting these people that, you know, are really distrustful and hateful towards each other. So I think we can design better.
You know, I'll just echo that. That design does really matter. I know Lynn and I spend a lot of time hanging on architects, so it's easy for us to parrot that. But there is a lot of research that backs that up, and that if you treat people with dignity and you give them light and you give them access to, you know, open spaces, then they'll actually behave better. And, you know, I don't want to spend too much time glorifying the Scandinavian the design principles, but they do seem to have some substance behind them. I just wanted to show you really quickly. This is a court that I visited last year in Denmark, and this is their high security court. This is a part of the suburb of Copenhagen that has serious gang violence. It has a lot of high crime. It has you know, the most serious cases that are quite serious. There is still high crime in Copenhagen. This is where they hold their trials, and that's their most secure courtroom. And what you see, the closest facing people, that's the defense, the bar table, and that's the defendant sits with their client. And when you see at the back, that's the public gallery, and that's what's behind glass. I took the picture myself, so it's kind of poor quality, but you see, now we can debate whether or not we want the problems with glassing off the public, and the image of the leadership at the end, I think, is really, really problematic. But this is how they deal with security, is that, and we spoke to judges and we spoke to counsel about how they, you know, how trials go, and they think it, and they say, well, you know, if you treat people with respect, then they'll behave well, and that seems to be a guiding principle, and for the most part, that seems to work. In American courts, now, you know, they do all sorts of dodgy security stuff that's meant to be kind of, you know, unseen in terms of the sun belts and the shackling to the floor. That's true in a small number of cases, but in most cases, you know, we have this image of courts being full of kind of like armed police officers, you know, up and down America. That's not actually the case. Most trials don't have police officers. They might have sheriffs, but not necessarily armed. And, you know, justice happens, right? There's a very only small number of maybe high-profile violent, you know, security breaches, but that's not the norm at all. And as, I mean, Abby's case was really, most violence happens in family court. We know that. That's what the data suggests. That's where emotions are high. We're not going to suggest putting people in the dock in family court, I don't think. But that's what we need to that's where we need to think about things.
Okay. Any more questions or points? Yeah.
Just to respond to the call for information, I've been doing some research with children and young people who live in the police station, and they talk a lot about, so I ask them about, those times when they get very frustrated and kick off, as they might say it. And it's all about being in a small box, and it's all about not being able to understand the noise that comes through the buzzer on the wall, feeling people aren't communicating with you, and not being able to make yourself understood. And that is all the circumstances, arguably, you might say, that are combined in that doc. Mm-hmm. And my experience of representing young people who have to sit in docs is exactly that. But they get themselves in trouble, don't they, in the courtroom, because either they kick off or they just talk to their mate who's sitting next to them. And it's setting young people up to fail, particularly, by putting them in a box in that very difficult setting. So, yeah, I'll speak to you.
Thank you.
It's an actively negative problem.
Yeah. Yes.
Great presentation. Just on reflection from what I've been hearing, it seems to me, and I might be completely wrong, that this isn't just, the doc is very much a symptom of a wider issue, how we treat defendants. It doesn't start at the doc. So you go back a little bit, held in cells, police cells, before interviews. That's a cramped space. That's no space to reflect on how you're going to give what is, in effect, your first piece of evidence to interviewing police officers in a very hostile environment, an intimidating environment. Never mind after conviction, when the conditions of prisons are far worse. But these are people who are presumed innocent, and from the get-go, they're put in very cramped environments. They're treated as though they aren't innocent, and so forth. And the doc is just a symptom of that. And it seems to me that we have to reflect on how we treat defendants throughout the process, from the arrest. So that's my
thank you. Yes.
I just wondered if there's any handle on empirical data on public opinion, and does public opinion matter? I mean, my own research on public attitudes to sentencing is they tend to be rather punitive. So we haven't talked about the kind of shaming aspect of the doc and what that does. I just can envisage, you know, if there was an abolition of the doc and we have an attack on the judge, the D-mail would be an overdrive. So I just wondered whether, A, there is any data on public opinion, and B, does it matter? Should public opinion be leading or following in this case?
That's a great question. There isn't. And I might hazard a guess that Most people haven't been to court. And most of what we know about courts comes, even in this country, from American crime dramas. So I think that actually a lot of people would be really shocked to find out about docs. And I know that from speaking to friends and students and things. And we send our students to court. Linda and I teach the first years. And it usually is actually a bit of a shock that they don't quite realize that's where. And even, the first time I went to court, I'm American, the first time I went to see a Crown Court here, I was completely taken aback, because I also grew up on American crime dramas. So you might argue that it's a bit, that if the public actually knew, maybe there would be more of an outcry. But I also take your point that actually maybe we do have a really punitive public, so we don't know what the response would be.
Can I also add to that? I mean, I'm really interested in the Court Standards Working Party and how it's conducted its business over the last 50 years. It's largely an intra-government department committee that their minutes do not see the light of day. They got pulled up in front of the National Audit Office and the PAC in the 80s. But apart from that, nobody really knows that they exist. But very early on, they decided not to have any lay users on their panel. And I think that's really interesting, because they will routinely, consistently and routinely consult the Bar Council, the Law Society, the judiciary. They never ask representatives of victims or defence. They've never invited the Howard League or Justice. They've occasionally knocked on the door because they realise something is happening in court design. So I think that raises a really important question about who's been consulted about this. And it has actually, it's a record. In the National Archives, there was a point at which the Court Standards Working Party said, we don't need to consult these people because they have their proxies. Well, with all due respect, their proxies have at times been the Bar Council, who haven't always had the interests of the defendant, I don't think, in the fore in these discussions. So rather distressingly, as these things are happening to the doc, I could tell you some quite interesting stories about what lawyers are claiming for in terms of their space in the courtroom. Do they want flip-up seats? No, they'd rather have swivel chairs. Could they have more room now that they've got computers as well as papers? And this is happening as the writing desk is being taken away, so it's really music to my ears to hear that, you know, the bar is really taking an interest in this now. That's really, yeah, disappointing.
Okay, well, you're nearly out of time, and Paula has to go. I have one more question, if you're quick.
I was just wondering what actually are, and further to your comment, what actually are the reasons for having a dock? So you said security, and that defence counsel may not want to actually sit next to